You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. You're going to enjoy today's pod. It's with Bastian Bergman, who is the co-founder and COO of Solston, a technology startup that empowers companies to build deeply resonating human-centered experiences for their audiences. Among its customers are globally recognized companies and brands such as Zynga, Electronic Arts, Sony, DraftKings, Peloton, Dentsu. You've heard of all of those. He's also a former consultant at Boston Consulting Group, and he has a new book. It's called Press Play, Why Every Company Needs a Gaming Strategy. Enjoy the pod. Bastian Bergman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Really excited to be here.
Before we discuss how companies need a gaming strategy, I'd love for us to set the stage on why gaming, or more broadly, play, is so vital to the human condition, human development, our culture. And I'm reminded of a great George Bernard Shaw quote. He said, quote, "We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing," end quote. Does that resonate with you?
I don't think I have anything to add to that. That about sums it up. It's, another quote that comes to mind around the importance of play is what Plato supposedly said, or at least it's attributed to Plato, where it says, "Show me how you play and I can tell you who you are." And I think that's really that quote in conjunction with the one that you had, that you shared. That's really what it's about. You know, there's from an evolutionary perspective, there's almost nothing that's more human, fundamentally more human than to play. If you've ever observed a toddler, you know, I have two kids, they're still fairly young. If you've ever observed children, how they learn about the world and how they experience the world, it's through play. And when you look at our adult brains and how we learn best, you know, at an advanced age, how we rewire our brains, play is the most effective form of that. And I think that's where, when you look at all of the data now in terms of consumers and people in general, because consumers are human beings. It's not like this, you know, foreign object. It's like, oh, there's this group of consumers and then there's us as humans. That's like, that's who we are. They're human beings. And where they're spending the majority of their time, where they're spending the majority of their attention, where they're engaged the most, et cetera, the list goes on. It's inside video games, or call it gamified immersive environments. And the reason why all of those environments are so effective at attracting and then captivating our attention is because they are effectively a digital manifestation of play.
So it's interesting. I've talked about this before on the podcast. One of the reasons this podcast exists is I wrote a book about how we take our improv games into businesses to help them be more creative, for decision-making, for leadership, all those things. What I have known to be true up until now, because we tested it, is if I call it play, they don't pay us money to do these things. So we call it improvisation, which it is. But it's like, and I don't know if that's going to change. But I mean, you're familiar with this concept because you even say in the book, like, this is like been around for a while now. It's pretty important, both as you mentioned, evolutionary, but also in this modern context of what you're talking about with video games. I don't know. Are people going to catch up at some point, do you think?
I mean, my first question to you would be, it sounds like you're suggesting I might need to change the title of my book so people start paying me for
don't change it. I think you need to open – someone has to be a sacrificial lamb for opening the door. It's going to be you, I'm afraid.
No, but it's you're hitting on an important point. You know, there's this almost stigma around play where it's like play's not – serious, like fun, quote unquote, is not serious. And, you know, it couldn't be further from the truth. And I think what's interesting about what you just shared is it's symptomatic of the challenge that gaming as an industry has in terms of its perception of the potential and the potency that it has for companies and brands to leverage it as a medium, as a touch point to engage consumers. Because there's all these stereotypes around it. There's all these misconceptions around it. Well, to play is not, it's not, you can't be serious that way. Like, you know, you're not an adult, yada, yada. And then there's a stereotype of, well, a gamer, quote unquote, is this 18-year-old dude in a basement, you know, slinging Red Bull cans, and there's neon lights in the background, and they're blowing stuff up on their computer screen when they're playing a shooter game. And the reality is, that is a stereotype. I'm not saying that persona doesn't exist. They absolutely do exist, but it's an absolute minority if you look at the global gaming population. And here's the reality. Almost 3.5 billion people now play games regularly. So it's not just young audience. Fastest growing segment in terms of adoption, in terms of like weekly hours spent, albeit it's coming off of a smaller base, is 80 years old and above.
Wow.
So, and that's the crazy thing. When people start asking me about it and go, well, but this is only for like Gen Z or Gen Alpha, or this is for young people. I'm like, okay, but did you know that literally 84% of all internet users play games, literally. And it's 80% of the folks that have access to the internet with a smartphone. So you go, you talk about those stats, and, you know, once people realize that, you know, back to the 3.5 billion number, that's more people play than the population of China and India combined. It's bigger than any religion we've ever had on planet Earth. So once you start to compare it and contrast it to things that are more tangible to people, it slowly, but then they get there. And then once you can look beyond the stereotypes and beyond the misconceptions, that's when almost a whole nother world opens up for you about how you think about this space in and of itself, and then in relation to how that might help your business achieve its goals, depending on what strategic pathways you choose.
So I imagine you or your editor were like, all right, you gotta open this thing with a story where people are going to see what you're talking about. And so you start with Burberry, which I did not see coming at all. Like Burberry, yeah, they put themselves in a game, made some dough. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it's weird because, you know, outside in, a lot of people had the reaction that you had and go, wait, the company with the, you know, the checkered pattern and like the trench coat, $4,000 trench coats. I don't even know what they're going for these days, and like really expensive scarves and all that. Like, what the hell are they doing in a video game? And what's interesting is you weren't the only person to have that reaction. I had a similar reaction, you know, even the CEO of the gaming company that they ended up working with, John Lindman, he's the CEO and founder of Mythical Games. He had that same reaction when they approached him. He goes, what are you talking about? Like they laughed at that idea. But Burberry had a very clear plan. And you know, where they're coming from, once you start to dig into it, it makes a lot of sense, because for them, their traditional customer, their core customer, the audience that is aware of Burberry, loyal to Burberry, that's maybe purchased some of those items, it's not only a slightly older demographic, but the point is that those shopping behaviors of the demographic that they're targeting, or that they've historically targeted, are radically different than the new generation that's aging in, both from an income perspective as well as like part of, you know, point in their life where they can A, afford those items, and maybe B, need a trench coat in the first place, or like an expensive tie or what have you. And so those people no longer go, you know, to a store downtown to browse the windows and see what's there and go into a store and try on 15 different items, and they leave and they go to the next store. Their shopping journey starts online, because these people predominantly live digitally. And that's what Burberry realized. And go, well, if we want to get in front of these consumers, if we want to be relevant to the people that are now aging into the demographic that we need to have a relationship with, if we don't want to have a dying business, because our core audience right now is aging out, they're getting older and older and older, we have to meet them where they are. And they looked at all of the numbers, and it's like, they're playing video games. That's where they are. So they integrated with this game called Blankos, which is a really cool sandbox open world game. You could do a bunch of stuff with it. That's why it was a really good fit, because it allowed for a lot of self-expression, a lot of creativity, a lot of freedom. You could do a lot with the characters in the game. In long story short, they launched a limited edition character set, 750 of them, $300 a pop per character, mm-hmm. alongside a virtual clothing line. So that was basically mirroring their latest runway collection that they had. So you could dress up your character. People were able to trade these items. And there was an after sales marketplace. So you could see if you had a character and that was like a really unique one, it was appreciating in value. Like there's all this stuff after the fact. And the crazy thing is it took 22 seconds to sell out all of those characters. So they made over $220,000 in 22 seconds. And I think the money is the one component, but more importantly, it took them 22 seconds to literally crack the door wide open to an entirely new consumer demographic that they, up until that point, had been completely out of touch with.
Did someone get a coat, or does this all live in that universe?
This lived in that universe, but wow. What you're alluding to is where, you know, brands like Adidas specifically, mm-hmm. like Adidas is at the absolute forefront of connecting virtual to physical. And that's one of the, you know, biggest potentials and just the potency of gaming. There's 86%, I believe is the statistics, the exact number of people that have bought an item only like inside of a video game have proceeded to purchase the corresponding physical item. Mm-hmm. If it exists. There's an 86% conversion rate from virtual to physical. And that starts to tell you and paint the picture of the upside of these brands of being relevant and being present in those digital spaces, because one, as in the case of Burberry, it can be a revenue driver for you. It doesn't need to be solely for brand awareness. And now people are talking about Burberry, but then nothing else. Like they made actual money off of it, but then you can start to connect it to the physical world. Nike with Artifact. I have a pair of sneakers. You know, that wasn't a purely, you know, gamified play. That was more around NFTs. But it's those examples where you get something in those virtual environments, in those games. You could wear it. It's part, becomes part of your identity, self-expression. You wear it around. And then, you know, the company has a big opportunity to go, you know, you might as well have it in the real world too. And yeah. Adidas is one of the examples that's at the absolute forefront of this.
It's such an interesting time to be alive. Because so my dad worked in radio for 33 years, WGN radio. Like, so I grew up in that doesn't exist. All our friends were, because it was for the Chicago Tribune. So all my friends in print media, that doesn't exist in the same way. My industry, I heard a stat the other day, I think it was on Derek Thompson's podcast, that the television film industry is 40% down. Now, if any other industry were 40% down in this country, it would be front page news on the paper. But I think because it's actors and other stuff, they don't think about it. But that, you know, the lineage at Second City is all these people, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, mm-hmm. they all start here. And then that's where they go. It's like, well, where are they going now? And all you got to do is watch some TV and suddenly like Jennifer Aniston and Harrison Ford are doing commercials and sitcoms. It's like there's no – so the world we lived in with billboards and print and all that is going. And so I think what you're saying is, well, it's not that people aren't having their eyes on stuff and that they're in different places where you can do that. It is where you are. It's where the games are.
That's exactly it. And, you know, interestingly, I was looking up some stats earlier today. This is from 2010, and it speaks to exactly the example that you just gave. In 2010, consumers globally spend about 31% of their media consumption, all of the media, whether it's TV, newspapers, everything. 31% was spent on the internet, on online media and entertainment, only 31%. This is only 15 years ago. And at that time, internet advertising made up 5% of the entire global advertising market. 5%. The rest, billboards, TV, newspapers, you just mentioned all of them.
Yeah.
Fast forward to today, this is the crazy part. Video games get, on average, depending on like the consumer demographic, it varies a little bit by country, but on average, consumers spend about 25% of the media consumption, of all of their media consumption, happens is in games or on games. So it's gaming in 25%. So it's very similar to where social media was at 15 years ago. You know how much total advertising spend games get today?
No.
5%.
Wow.
So it's right. Literally, that's the example. It's where gaming right now is where social media was at about 15 years ago. It commands way more time, way more engagement, way more attention than all of these other mediums, yet global advertising spend hasn't caught up yet. Whereas social media today gets almost 41% of the entire total global advertising spend. And that's the shift that we're about to see, because the flow of advertising dollars is always a little bit delayed. It takes time for people to catch up, you know, with all the stereotypes that we talked about. There's novelty around these different mediums. And that was, you know, looking back, part of why I ended up writing this book in the first place, because, you know, it's not that I'm bored with two young girls on deck. It's like there's plenty to yeah. do. But I was on a call with the global marketing leadership team of Danone 4 years ago. And Danone's an incredibly well-run company. These people are really smart. They're very good at what they do. They wanted to talk to me about their digital strategy and specifically their gaming strategy. And I just asked them, like, this is fantastic that you guys are going into this space. What do you want to do? And then they said, well, we're going to sponsor an esports team. And I said, okay. And I made a mistake and I asked them a question. And I said, what else do you guys want to do? Uh-huh. And they muted the call. They start talking amongst themselves. And then I think it was the marketing leader for like Evian. She unmutes the call and she goes, what do you mean? What else are we doing? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh no. So then the whole conversation shifted to us talking about, well, what is gaming? And I just walked away from that conversation thinking, if Danone is struggling with this, well, how many other companies are struggling with this? And I think that's the example where, because of those stereotypes, a lot of misconceptions, gaming just works fundamentally differently to like a lot of other marketing or consumer engagement channels that people are used to and comfortable with. Yet, you know, despite all the engagement metrics, all the attention, all the monetization, all that, you have lagging marketing dollars being put into that space. And I think that's just the perfect example. Well, we've been in this place before, and that was 15 years ago, and that place was called social media. And we all know how that went and how massive that change was. So we're on the precipice of just another, you know, pretty incredible wave that we've already seen before.
I think this is another example where, and this is an improv thing, where people have to become comfortable with their lack of knowledge, that we don't have all the answers. You've got to be curious. And I specifically have this experience with the podcast because about 4 months ago, we decided to put it on YouTube, which is kind of the thing you're supposed to do now. And, you know, we got like the bigger episodes got maybe 120 views. Now we do much better on Spotify and those other. So my Kate, who I work with, my dear friend Kate, when COVID happened and we had to lay her off, she worked for a company that sort of like played around with stuff on YouTube. And she goes, hey, you know, I'm going to put like a $200 spend on last week on the upcoming podcast, which was with Colin Fisher. Lo and behold, right now it's sitting at 7.7 thousand views.
Wow.
$200.
Yep.
And those episodes are being listened 80% of the way through. Wow. Which is a very big, that's a high number.
Yeah.
So it's like the game's changed and it's fine. And it's fine that we're late. That's good. We're a theater. It's whatever. But like, it is time to wake up because you're just not going to find audiences in the same way. And you know, we're already having these conversations at Second City now. Like, what's the game? Our owner, the private equity group that bought us is owns Take Two Games.
There you go.
So maybe
you have access to the source. That's great.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about the six stages of video game development process that you talked about, because it mirrors almost exactly the creative development process at Second City. So you start with ideation. Mm-hmm. We start with, and by the creative process, I mean, we write an original show in front of an audience over a 12-week period. That's what Second City does. We don't come in with scripts. The actors write and perform. There's a director, but that's what happens. So Number one, ideation. For us, that is hiring the director, the cast, and we have early creative meetings. Concepting. For us, that's the first 4 weeks of the process. That's the yes and idea. We just put everything up, kitchen sink. That's what we do. Three, prototyping. That's the following 4 weeks where we're testing out the material and the stuff that's not getting laughs, chuck it away. The stuff that is, we're playing with it. Soft launch, previews. That's where we're previewing. We kind of have the show and we're playing with it. Five, global launch. That's opening night for us. That's when the critics come see it. Then six, you have live operations. And I would call that the run of the show here because stuff will happen in the world where we're like, 9/11 being the, worst, where it was like, take out every reference to an airplane. But there's small things like that, that during the 9, 10, 11 months that a show runs that you're tweaking. It's that you're never closed. The show's never quite over. And you talk about that. It's like a perfect map.
Yep. Yeah, it really is. And I think that speaks to improv in general, or like, I mean, fundamentally, what are we talking about? We're talking about creative endeavors. Play is creative. If you're sort of like, if you're going down the movie path, that's a creative endeavor. Making games is a creative endeavor. Improv, comedy, all of those are creative endeavors. And, I didn't know this. So this is new to me. So I just learned something really cool. Thank you for sharing that. But when you really think about it, I'm also not surprised that that's part of the flow, because, all of those things start with, okay, somewhat of an idea. And then you take what is super vague into, well, what could that be? And what are maybe different manifestations of that? That's concepting. Do we go left? Do we go straight? What are the different shades of red that we're applying to this? Or should we maybe use purple? It's all of those sorts of questions. And then prototyping is, okay, well, let's try and put, try and put the base components of this airplane together to see if it, does it maybe, is it ready for takeoff? Does it fly just a little bit?
Like, just a little bit.
Is it fun? Like, are if you put it in front of 50 people, are five going to laugh at least? It's like those types of questions. And the same is true. The same is true for games. And I think sometimes companies and leaders, when they think about gaming and their strategy and wanting to go down this path, they ask me, this is one of the most common questions I get. It's, well, where do we start? Yeah. And what is the minimum thing that we could do? Like, how do we not risk everything? How do we not place a major bet? And I think following this process is really, really important, because as a part of that, you have to test against your actual audience. You're using a lot of audience insights to understand, who is this really for? Who are the types of people? Why are we ideating around this? Why are we concepting a certain way? If I want, certain reactions and certain emotional connections with the audience that I'm trying to reach. So there's a really important component where understanding who you're making something for, that's the foundation for it all. And I think if you follow this process, you ideate more quickly. Concepting, prototyping prevents you from going down paths where all of a sudden you have a team of 50 people building something for 3 years. They launch it and they go, womp, womp. Well, that didn't work.
Yeah.
You're going to find out much, much sooner. So you're de-risking your whole process by following that. And, when you talk about game development, people get scared right away, and it is hard. Making games is very hard. There's no denying that, but it doesn't have to be super expensive. It doesn't need to be, you mentioned Take Two. It doesn't need to be Grand Theft Auto 6 supposedly costs more than $1 billion to make. Like, that's the wrong end of the spectrum to start. You can start with something much leaner, much smaller, let alone pick an existing game that's already live, like Burberry did. Partner with it and integrate with it. Your upfront cost and your ramp up to doing that is, it's marginally zero. Like, it's not that significant.
I gave a talk last week, and in the sort of lead up to it, this group wanted it was scientists, and they needed them to be more sort of risk tolerant. Mm-hmm. And so I was talking to them about the fact that I get asked to speak at a lot of creativity and innovation conferences. And one of the things I always do is say, there are two different things. First of all, they get conflated. you can have creativity with zero innovation. Happens all the time. A lot of bad stuff out there. But unfortunately, you can't have innovation without creativity.
Yeah.
Which means you have to have a certain level of mess tolerance. That was the, mm-hmm. that was the word choice I came up with. And these companies, it's probably the norm to not have a place where that mess tolerance exists. Yep. It doesn't in these creative industries, because we know that we're writing new stuff and there's got to be demos, and that's why we have an improv set and all that. But, and you talk about this in the book, that before you even enter into this space for a business, you got to make sure everyone understands what this process might look like, and there's going to be failures. Because if there isn't, it's going to be stuck in its tracks. And then 100%. Also, yeah, if you don't know your audience, and you brought that up too.
Yeah, 100%. It is a creative endeavor, and those never follow a straight line. It's like, yeah. What are most companies going to compare it to? Either like a software development path, or maybe like a manufacturing, depending on where the industry, where the company's from, which industry they're in. Those are really poor analogies, because it is a squiggly line. Mm-hmm. That's your point, mess tolerance. It is a squiggly line until you get to something where you go like, oh, we might have struck gold. The question is, can you reduce the amount of squiggles that you're taking along the way? Like, it's going to be messy, period. But how messy is it going to be, and how detrimental/costly is that going to be along the way? And that audience understanding, really investing upfront deeply into, this is who we're making this for. These are the real needs and desires and drivers of that audience. And now how does that manifest itself in sort of a gaming environment, or in which games are these people already present, and how do we authentically show up in those spaces, is going to save you a ton of time and money. Regardless, when you look at companies like Peloton, that's an example that I feature in the book, and people go like, Peloton, what do they have to do with games? Like, because it's very different than even a Burberry or an Adidas example. But they made a video game that became workout content. So rather than having an instructor yell at you while you're on mm-hmm. your Peloton bike sweating and hoping that the workout's done soon, you can actually do your workout inside of a video game. It's called Lane Break, and it's a bike simulator. It's a racing game, and it simulates your workout as you're biking, but it's a full-fledged game. And they developed that internally. They had a dedicated team, and it was shielded away from all the other traditional budgeting processes. They had a flexible budget around it. Yes, it wasn't unlimited, but there was flexibility in terms of, now we need to spend more, now we can pull back a little bit. And they gave the team the time and space, fully understanding and knowing that we can't put a timeline on it and say, well, in 3 months, it's going to be ready to get launched. Could be 3 months, might be 9. It could be 12. And the person leading that team at that point, his name is Jim Green, they asked him, I asked him like, well, what did you tell him? When do you know that you're going to, he's like, when you're going into soft launch and you have those metrics, you know. But other than that, like, the company, the organization has to be comfortable with, this is a fundamentally different process if you're going down that path and building. And I said earlier that it's hard, and even companies like Disney, which I'd argue is one of the, if not the best company at providing experiences for consumers. It's the experience company.
Yeah.
If you look at Disney's relationship with gaming over the last 30 years, I have a really cool chart on it. It's like, I put on the one axis is the time, and then on the other axis I put, well, what did they do with gaming? Is it like, we only license our IP? We're working directly with other video games, so we're a part of it, or we have game development in-house and we're trying to make the games ourselves. So it's like the level of involvement that they're getting. And if you look at their journey over the last 30 years, their relationship with gaming is like this. It looks like a bipolar relationship. They're like on, off, on, off, on, off, because they got it right, then they never could get it quite right, then they pulled out of it, and then they go into the space again. That's the bottom line. It's really, really hard, but grounding yourself in your audience up front it de-risks a lot of that process, and it takes some of those squiggles out of that journey.
I was having a flashback when I was reading the book, and I would never call myself a gamer in any regard. Yeah, I don't play. But I do the New York Times crossword every day.
There you go.
Years ago, I was like 20 years ago, as I was sort of my kid, I have kids, right? Mm-hmm. And I see them engaging with games and starting to sort of feel those. And I recognized that this company that had real big success, and I'm forgetting the name of the game, but the guy who did it was Alex Seropian, who became sort of famous and developed this game. I got a meeting with him and his partner. They were in River North, and we actually tried to co-develop what would a Second City video game look like. And my pal TJ Jagodowski, who's a wonderful improviser, we improvised a bunch of stuff in workshops. We tried it out in front of audiences, and basically we created a talk show where he was the referee from NBA Jams, and he only interviewed other video game characters. And like, it was a lot of fun to do. But the reason it never went forward was Alex's company got bought by Disney. And then he went to the West Coast to head up gaming for them. And that lasted about 3 years, right? And it's like someone bought someone, and then he was working for EA, and then he was working. And now Electronic Arts is the biggest private buyout ever.
Yep. Biggest leverage buyout in the history of leverage buyouts.
How is that not front page news? Like, it's not.
That's the crazy part, because I was having a lot of conversations on this over the past couple of weeks with different people, and I honestly think it's a very smart move for everyone involved, and honestly, it's a very smart move on the part of Saudi Arabia. Because if you look at their Vision 2030 strategy of what they're, they're trying to literally take an entire economy that they have that's based on oil and gas and turn it around, knowing that at some point they're going to run out of those resources. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly, incredibly smart for them to do that proactively. And then you take, okay, gaming, it's cultural. Culture lives and exists and thrives and emerges within gaming environments. So if you own some of those environments, you're going to be privy to observing what happens, understanding what happens, maybe even shaping and influencing culture to an extent. And then the other component on this is EA still to this day makes somewhere between 80 to 85% of its entire revenue from its sports franchises.
Yeah.
So what is the other big piece that the kingdom has invested in like crazy over the last 10 years? Football/soccer.
Soccer. Yep.
Why? It's the world's game. 4 billion people are actively engaged with soccer in one shape or form. So you put those two together, you arguably have the two strongest cultural forces and the connective tissue between gaming and sports and fandom around that. To me, it's an incredibly smart deal. It's an incredibly smart deal. And I agree with you. The fact that Bloomberg did some reporting on it, some of it was good. Some of it I thought was pretty misguided. They were focusing on the wrong things. But other than that, I had the same reaction as you. I'm like, how is this not a bigger deal?
It's funny. I was walking. We have a 7-month-old puppy. She's a Bernese Mountain Dog. And I was taking her for a walk this weekend, and I had my Tottenham flag out. Mm-hmm. And then I saw on the same block, there was a Man United flag and an Aston Villa flag. And I'm like, wow, this little neighborhood in Chicago, like it's worldwide at this point. I mean, I grew up as a soccer player. So, and my brothers were, so I was into it, but it's amazing because it's a very similar thing of like, and it's why the NBA, right, is in China.
Yep.
Everyone's playing that same game. Okay. I could talk to you forever. I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast.
Yeah. So yes and, a time where I should have said no, or I normally would have said no.
Normally would have said no, and then you said yes. Yeah. So what happened?
I'll give you, I put some thought into this, and there's both, one from my professional life, but I'm going to share the one from my personal life with you guys. So I met my wife 10 years ago, pretty much on the dot 10 years ago. We both moved to Berlin at the time for work, and we worked coincidentally at the same exact company, different teams. But I was like co-leading that company, and she was working on a team there, and we met. And I fell for her. And normally I would have said, no, you can't do that. It's the same, same workplace. You can't do that. But I said, yes. And here we are. We're married 7 years. We have two wonderful daughters. She's one in a billion. And it's the best time I said yes when I could have said no easily, probably in my whole life.
Yeah. Same. My wife hired me in the box office at Second City, and we were both getting married to other people at the time. My wife, Ann, actually caught the bouquet at my first wedding.
Nice.
And then our marriages broke up. And when we got together, everyone here is like, oh, that's not good. Like, that's like, you're both executives at the company. But, you know, 30 years later, you know, we're still together. So, yeah, I love it. The book is called Press Play, Why Every Company Needs a Gaming Strategy. Bastian Bergman, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. This was awesome. Thank you.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.